You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Aloud at Central Library. I'm sorry about the parking situation, but these things happen, so thank you for your forbearance. I'm Louise Steinman, the curator of the Aloud series and the co-curator with Kate Gale of tonight's wonderful poetry program with these distinguished poets. So I want to thank you so much for coming, let you know that each poet will be reading, and Kate will be telling you a little bit more about that, and they will be signing afterwards. And I just wanted you to know that this program is presented to you free by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, and we'd love to tell you more about the Library Foundation. You can also find out more about Red Hen Press, our co-presenter in the lobby afterwards. And just a few notes, if you want to pick up our new summer series postcard with our upcoming events, our next poetry event will be on July 25th, which is titled Resist, Disrupt, Transgress for Poets. And we have information about that on here, and there's some great programs with Roxane Gay and others. And now I know you're going to settle in for a wonderful evening of readings, and I want to introduce my distinguished co-curator of tonight and the co-founder with her husband Mark Cull of Red Hen Press, Kate Gale, a wonderful poet herself.
Well, we are so excited to be back here at the Central Library because this is the most magnificent place to do a reading, particularly a poetry reading in Los Angeles. So we should all support the Library Foundation. Could we just give a round of applause to Louise for all the hard work she does? So tonight, you're going to hear seven poets read a bit of their own work and a bit of someone else's work. They'll each tell you who they are and who they're reading, so you won't be confused. But I wanted to say that Louise and I, over a number of drinks, it took a while, and we had the forbearance to keep working. We decided to pair each poet with someone that they would be reading. And it's when you hear this reading, I'm sure you will think at some point, wow, that's very curious that they made that pairing. And sometimes you'll think that's wonderful. And I think that both wonderful and curious are fantastic things to have in poetry. I'm going to mention one other thing before I read the list of poets who will be reading. Red Hen Press has been publishing for 23 years. We moved to Pasadena in 2010. As of this year, we're moving into permanent space in Pasadena. 7,200 square feet. When we invite you all to the groundbreaking ceremony in September, it will be one big raw space, and we will hopefully have fixed the roof. The place is currently being used as a church, so it still may have the baptismal font, but we will be in the process of getting this ready to be an amazing place for poetry and literature in Pasadena and in Los Angeles. So don't worry, you'll all be invited to an amazing party in September. So without further ado, I'm going to give you the order in which the poets will be reading tonight. And each one of them, as I said, will introduce themselves very briefly. Kim Dower, Victoria Chang, Brendan Constantine, Blas Falconer, Bryn Saito, Amy Gerstler, and Douglas Kearney. Please welcome to the stage Kim Dower.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here tonight. And yes, my name is Kim Dower. I am the Poet Laureate of West Hollywood, which is very exciting. And when I walk down the street, I'm often confused for Gertrude Stein, who I'm here tonight representing. Now, I wore this because a rose is a rose is a rose. And I also want to say thank you to Louise Steinman for this wonderful event and this beautiful library, and Kate Gale and everyone at Red Hen Press for putting this together. So how many know who Gertrude Stein is? There you go. See, I didn't need this little bio. But when we think of her, we think about Paris in the 20s and her amazing salons and Picasso and Hemingway. We don't think of her as a girl growing up in Oakland. But that's the truth. She was a girl growing up in Oakland. And what I just heard tonight, which I didn't know in my research, is she invented the expression, "There is no there there." That's Gertrude Stein. And no offense to anyone from Oakland, but she wrote that about Oakland. So on that note, I've chosen some, it's hard to choose what to read of Gertrude Stein's, but here we go. Pigeons on the grass, alas. Pigeons on the grass, alas. Short, longer grass. Short, longer, longer, shorter, yellow grass. Pigeons on the grass. If they were not pigeons, what were they? If they were not pigeons on the grass, alas, what were they? He had heard of a third, and he asked about it. It was a magpie in the sky. If a magpie in the sky, on the sky, cannot cry, if the pigeon on the grass, alas, can alas, and to pass the pigeon on the grass, alas, and the magpie in the sky, on the sky, and to try, alas, on the grass, alas, the pigeon on the grass, the pigeon on the grass, and alas. They might be very well. They might be very, very well. They might be. So there you go. That's Gertrude Stein. Thank you. So Gertrude Stein was much more interested in the sounds of words than in their meaning. And I'm going to start doing that when I write now. I think it sounds easy, but I guess it's probably not so easy. She was very interested in, when you put words together, what happens to them. So her second book, she was 40 when she wrote this book in 1914. It was called Tender Buttons. And she did a lot of different things with Tender Buttons. This is Tender Buttons Eggs. So just be there with me. Try to make this happen. Kind height, kind in the right stomach, with a little sudden mill. Cunning shawl to be steady. In white handkerchiefs with little dots in a white belt, all shadows are singular. They are singular and procured and relieved. I love that. They're relieved. No, that is not the cow's shame and a precocious sound. It is a bite. Cut up alone the paved way, which is harm. Harm is old boat and a likely dash. And there's the book of Tender Buttons, just objects. So this is called Nothing Elegant. A charm, a single charm, is doubtful. If the red is rose and there is a gate surrounding it, if inside is let in and there places changes, then certainly something is upright. It is earnest. Class, what does that mean? Wouldn't that be terrifying to be taught these in school and you'd have to come up with the meaning? So, a long dress. What is the current that makes machinery, that makes it crackle? What is the current that presents a long line and a necessary waste? What is the current? What is the wind? What is it? I love this one. The house was just twinkling in the moonlight, and inside it, twinkling with delight, is my baby bright. twinkling with delight in the house, twinkling with the moonlight. Bless my baby bright. Bless my baby twinkling with delight in the house, twinkling in the moonlight. Her hubby dear loves to cheer when he thinks, and he always thinks when he knows, and he always knows that his blessed baby wife is all here. And he is all hers and sticks to her like burrs, blessed baby. So, and that one I understand, sticks to her like burrs. It's like, oh my God, thank you. I could follow that to the next. So I'm going to read two of my poems that I think they chose me, not only because I look a lot like Gertrude Stein, but because my work is, I've been told, quirky, and sometimes whatever. It's hard to talk about one's own work. But I chose these two poems in honor of Gertrude Stein, and maybe she's watching and listening to us, and so happy we chose her to be part of this program. Do not disturb. I could sleep for days on a bed of lapels, my friend Deborah says. I understand. I could sleep for days on a couch of buttonholes. We're tired. Everyone's tired. My dog has been sleeping in a bed of dog hair all afternoon. I don't know why he's so tired. All he does is sleep. But I'm not trying to judge. I believe sleeping is as important as being awake, that we make our clearest decisions in the bleary gray moments of eyelid flutter, lifting our heavy legs in and out of the warm stream of dreams. Where sheep and cows float like barges through clouds, stray bullets catch breezes as we hold hands, jump through windows, wave goodbye to our dead loved ones who are wearing clothing we thought we discarded. Let's go to sleep now. Come here. Lie down beside me. It's our time to rest. Put on my golden pajamas, satin blindfold, scented with lavender. It's too late for us to be awakened by the trivial needs of others. I'm drowsy with expectations. Thank you. And I'll end with maybe Gertrude would have liked this poem. It's called Candlelight Asylum, and I think we should all write a going insane poem at one point or another. Maybe all of our poems are going insane poems, but this one's more obvious. It's called Candlelight Asylum. Do not enter my candlelight asylum, where we dance in our terry cloth robes, hair pinned up like discarded Barbies, our feet crushed in pink ballet slippers. I lied. There is no one here. I'm all alone, just me, in my grown-up sled bed. Comforter around my feet, head propped with flat pillows, no cases, yellow around the edges. A furnace coughing up wet music. This is no place for someone so alive, juicy, abundantly humane, so soft in her silk underwear. You may enter, but only you. You with the smile and dark hair. You with the stride, the hands. You look like you could get me out, and I trust that you will. Come on in. No one here but me and the candles, though they're burning fast, room darkening as the breeze pours through the windows. I don't even know your name or where you're from. Please take my slippers. No one is listening to my inside voice, my inside words. No one hears, not even the handsome nurse who brings me my tray of kisses. Oh, I lied again. There is no nurse. Don't believe a word I tell you, but please take me away. Do I have to wait for disaster before someone plucks me like the wilted daisy in the jar by the window, places me in clear water in a silver vase? Hurry before sunset goes bad. Join me on the last train to the missing planet. Thank you.
How's everyone doing? Good. I like going near the front so I can concentrate on people after me. Thank you so much, Louise and Kate and Toby and Keaton and Red Hen Press. I just wanted to say something quick about Red Hen. I was thinking about it as I was driving and circling and circling and circling that I think Red Hen has been really amazing in building community. You know, like we think of them as being like a press, but what they've done is just built just LA and beyond all these people that can see each other and meet each other. And I don't know, I feel like I have so many new friends just because of Red Hen Press. And so I just wanted to say thank you. I really appreciate it. So I'm doing Diane DePrima today. I'll just give you a quick and dirty bio. She was born August 6, 1934 in Brooklyn, New York, and she's still alive. She has a Facebook page. She was a member of the Beat Movement, and she developed friendships with John Ashbery, Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, Denise Levertov, Frank O'Hara, amongst others. And she wrote this famous book called Memoirs of a Beatnik. And she's authored more than 30 collections of poetry, plays, short stories, and she lives in San Francisco. So she's still writing and teaching, I think. It looked like her Facebook wasn't that active. So, yeah, I tried to message her, actually. I wanted to ask her a question. So I'm going to read two poems. The first one's a little bit longer. It's called Rant. And there's so many other people that are reading tonight that would do such a better job than me, but I'll do my best. Rant. You cannot write a single line without a cosmology, a cosmogony, laid out before all eyes. There is no part of yourself you can separate out saying, this is memory, this is sensation, this is the work I care about, this is how I make a living. It is whole, it is a whole, it always was whole. You do not make it so, there is nothing to integrate. You are a presence, you are an appendage of the work stems from, hangs from the heaven you create. Every man, every woman carries a firmament inside, and the stars in it are not the stars in the sky. Without imagination, there is no memory. Without imagination, there is no sensation. Without imagination, there is no will, desire. History is a living weapon in your hand, and you have imagined it. It is thus that you find out for yourself. History is the dream of what can be. It is the relation between things in a continuum of imagination. What you find out for yourself is what you select out of an infinite sea of possibility. No one can inhabit your world, yet it is not lonely. The ground of imagination is fearlessness. Discourse is videotape of a movie, of a shadow play, but the puppets are in your hand, your counters in a multi-dimensional chess, which is divination and strategy. The war that matters is the war against the imagination. All other wars are subsumed in it. The ultimate famine is the starvation of the imagination. It is death to be sure, but the undead seek to inhabit someone else's world. The ultimate claustrophobia is a syllogism. The ultimate claustrophobia is it all adds up. Nothing adds up, and nothing stands in for anything else. The only war that matters is the war against the imagination. The only war that matters is the war against the imagination. The only war that matters is the war against the imagination. All other wars are subsumed in it. There is no way out of a spiritual battle. There's no way you can avoid taking sides. There's no way you cannot have a poetics, no matter what you do, plumber, baker, teacher. You do it in the consciousness of making or not making your world. You have a poetics. You step into the world like a suit of ready-made clothes, or you etch in light your firmament, spills into the shape of your room, the shape of the poem, of your body, of your loves. A woman's life, a man's life is an allegory. Dig it. There's no way out of the spiritual battle. The war is the war against the imagination. You can't sign up as a conscientious objector. The war of the words, the world hangs here right now in the balance. It is a war for this world to keep it a veil of soul making. The taste in all our mouths is the taste of power, and it is bitter as death. Bring yourself home to yourself. Enter the garden. The guy at the gate with the flaming sword is yourself. The war is the war for the human imagination, and no one can fight it but you, and no one can fight it for you. The imagination is not only holy, it is precise. It is not only fierce, it is practical. Men die every day for the lack of it. It is vast and elegant. Intellectus means light of the mind. It is not discourse. It is not even language. The inner sun, the polis, is constellated around the sun. The fire is central. Another really short one of hers. She wrote this book called Revolutionary Letters, and it was written during the late 60s, and it was published by the Underground Press through the U.S. and abroad. It just feels really appropriate. So it's called, there's a ton of these, so you should go read them. They're all online. This one's called Revolutionary Letter Number 8. Every time you pick the spot for a be-in, a demonstration, a march, a rally, you are choosing the ground for a potential battle. You are still calling these shots. Pick your terrain with that in mind. Remember the old gang rules. Stick to your neighborhood. Don't let them lure you to Central Park every time. I would hate to stumble bloody out of that park to find help. Central Park West or Fifth Avenue, which would you choose? Go to Lovin's with incense, flowers, food, and a plastic bag with a damp cloth in it for tear gas. Wear no jewelry. Wear clothes you can move in easily. Wear no glasses, contact lenses. Earrings for pierced ears are especially hazardous. Try to be clear in front what you will do if it comes to trouble. If you're going to try to split, stay out of the center. Don't stampede or panic others. Don't waver between active and passive resistance. Know your limitations. Bear contempt. Neither for yourself nor any of your brothers. No one way works. It will take all of us shoving at the thing from all sides to bring it down. I think I'll just read one of mine from a new book that's coming out this fall. It's based on a third-person character named Barbie Chang, who's not me, but is sort of resembles me, I'll say. And this was funny to me because I just got back from New York. I was at a Guggenheim Fellowship reception, and so this, you'll see why this is funny. So it's called Some Days, Barbie Chang. Thank you so much. Some days, Barbie Chang wants to hang up her Asian boots and root for the circle. She wakes up not proud to be what she is. In a sea of water, who gets to decide which section of water eats the ship? It's always the white water that devours first. There are towers of people working in America, people all aiming for emeritus. She can't figure out how to open the door of the tower. Someone keeps lowering her down to the roof, but doesn't give her a rule book. Her mother gave her the wrong rouge, a ruler with no lines. Still, Barbie Chang doesn't want to appear rude, so she waits on the roof of Paul Muldoon's building. She wonders if she is standing on Paul Muldoon's head, how she wishes to win the Guggenheim like Paul Muldoon, to doom others like Paul Muldoon, to write rejection letters, sending them out the New Yorker windows. Sometimes in the winter, the letters take the snow down like dumb waiters. Thank you.
Hello. Before properly introducing my subject, I'm going to read only one poem of my own tonight, because I want the last words I say from the podium to be Wanda Coleman's. This is the first poem in my last book. It was written for Wanda. It's very short, and it's called Rule. If you break enough lines, eventually you have something that will kindle and catch like a tar paper shack or a wedding dress. A long-gone woman once took a stone to all her words until her tongue flared like a map of war. A library stands where she's buried, and people leave gifts in the parking lot. Rock, paper, scissors. Like the woman I have come to celebrate, I'm a poet born and raised in Los Angeles. My name is Brendan Constantine, and I was blessed enough to know my subject. I worked with Wanda, read with her, and she paid me the very great honor of her encouragement and her praise. Wanda Coleman was born in 1946 in Watts, grew up during the 1950s and 60s, and had what could be charitably described as a lonely childhood. She was the oldest of four children. She was tall, big-boned, awkward, very, very dark, and had what she called unconquerable kinky hair. And to make matters worse, she loved books and wanted to write. The challenges kept coming. She was repeatedly confronted with teachers that somehow could not reconcile the idea of a young black woman ingesting so much literature and wanting to follow in the footsteps of great writers, and they tried to dissuade her at every stop, but she persisted. Before she got out of high school, she was married, would soon have two children, but still got herself to Valley College and then to Cal State LA. And then it seems she had every single job in the newspaper trying to make sure that she could write. And she wrote up a storm. We're here to celebrate her poetry, but she did all kinds of writing. It should be noted that she did win an Emmy for writing daytime television. She gave us everything she had. And then in 2013, she left us 18 books of poetry, an amazing archive of work, and she left a crater in our city's literary identity. I'm going to dive right into that storm with Wanda's Business as Usual. You saw me when I came in, drawn by your fire sale sign. I have entered your shop to spend my slave's wages on goods you pretend are available to anyone. I have behaved like a lady, joined the line, and have stood here forever without complaining, even though my feet are screaming, and I'm suffering from a raging heartache. And now it's my turn to opt for what I want, and you suddenly do not see me, even though I'm as black as blazes, as tall as a drink of salt water, and as wide as two stadiums, even though I'm standing within stabbing distance. Your eyes see everything around me but me. And then you look straight at the white person behind me, lean forward and ask, "May I help you?" At least they have sense enough to squirm before I clear my throat. As I say, she had every job in the book, did a lot of office work. This is a different kind of business as usual poem. And for the younger writers in the room, I should elucidate one fact. She's going to reference a machine known as a Selectric. Many, 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 many years ago, there was a device known as an electric typewriter. And this back then, the internet was made of wood and ran on kerosene. That was an amazing typewriter, and a lot of us wrote a lot of poetry on them. Anyways, that's what a Selectric is. This is Rapping with Opportunity. I sit at the desk. It feels good to sit at a desk again. Good knowing money will be coming in again. Opportunity lights up a cigar and smiles. His pink round face is chapped from overexposure to wind and sun. White faces chap and peel like that. I wonder how he feels about my brown face. It doesn't matter as long as opportunity sees fit. I'll sit, pick up the phone and make a few calls, try the Selectric. My fingers glow, opportunity smiles. He doesn't suspect. If I ever get my hands on him, he'll never get away. I'll kill him and hide his body under my desk. For all the bravery and confidence of those two poems, she was as vulnerable as any of us. And this is, I think, exemplified in what is perhaps one of her best-known poems. This is Wanda in Worryland. I get scared sometimes and have to go look into the closet to see if his clothes are still there. I've been known to imagine a situation and then get involved in it, upset, angry, and cry hot tears. I have gone after people with guns. Once I tried to hang myself and got terribly ashamed afterwards because I was really faking it. I have gone after people with rocks. I have cursed out old white lady cart pushers in supermarkets who block the aisles in slow motion. I've gone after people with my fists. I have walked out on Pavlovian trainers who mistook me for a dog. I go to sleep and have dreams about falling and can't stand the suspense, so I sweat it out and land on my feet. I have gone after people with poems. I get scared sometimes and have to go look into the mirror to see if I'm still here. I could go on and on and on, and certainly somebody should. In fact, I printed out more poems than I could possibly read. Afterwards, come up and see me. I'm hoping that people will just take Wanda's poems from me. There's a few in here that I won't get to read. This is going to be the last one. I've read from the beginning and middle of her career books from the first book, Mad Dog Black Lady, and then from Mercurochrome, which was right about midway. This last poem is from her last book, The World Falls Away. She had a staggering range. I really, if you don't know Wanda's work, I highly recommend that you look into it. Particularly the book Mercurochrome is an education in poetry. The last portion of the book is just filled with emulations of other authors in an incredible range of styles and approaches, and she exemplifies each one brilliantly. This last poem, I think, also does indicate a kind of term. It is a gentler poem and a joyous one. This is Southerly Equinox. The age of the inner view dawns, and the need to be first is muted by a multitude of passings. Desire honed so sharp, the edges bleed. Lips and hands assume a silent patience, at rest as a savage brilliance is born, reborn in this ancient, ravaged griot. Who am I? What am I? Are no longer important questions. Knowing that I am is finally enough. Like discovering dessert is delicious following a disastrous meal. A sweetness that reawakens the palate, or finding that one's chalice is unexpectedly filled with elixir of euphoria. And I stumble happily into the cornucopia, arms outstretched, upturned, drunk, my heart athrum, bones full samba. The night blesses me with his constellations, baptizes me with his deathless autumnal chill, and I invade the moody indigo, full-throated and singing. Thank you.
Hello, I'm supposed to lower this. I'll wear heels next time. My name is Blas Falconer, and I'm going to be talking about Juan Felipe Herrera. In 2015, Juan Felipe Herrera became the 21st United States Poet Laureate. Announcing the appointment, Dr. Billington said, "I see in Herrera's poems the work of an American original, work that takes the sublimity and largesse of leaves of grass and expands upon it. His poems engage in a serious sense of play, in language and in image, that I feel gives them enduring power. I see how they champion voices and traditions and histories, as well as a cultural perspective, which is a vital part of our larger American identity." Maybe you should go lower. "I worked with Juan Felipe Herrera briefly at the Community of Writers at SQUAW. Before the workshop, he invited the students to stand up, to stretch, to introduce themselves, to dance, to strike a pose, to send good vibes to one another, inviting all to welcome a spirit of celebration. Perhaps the most powerful advice he offered at the conference was the idea of the sister poem, the idea that we can find multiple ways of telling our stories or stories that we need to tell. For example, one sister poem is the 'This is what happened' poem, while another is the 'This is what I didn't tell you when I told you what happened' poem, or the 'This is what I can't ever, under any circumstances, don't even ask, tell you' poem. Each sister poem standing together, pressing us to move beyond what comes easily. I'd like to read three of Juan Felipe Herrera's sister poems to celebrate his enormous body of work and his spirit of courage, generosity, his humor and wit, his thoughtfulness, his tendency to look beyond himself toward community and toward justice with a sense of compassion that we could all use in times like these. You throw a stone. You throw a stone. I throw a stone. I throw a stone. You throw a stone. Then a rocket comes down here. I lay next to you. We are brothers in a way without a sky. My father's house is empty. Your mother's house has no amber light as it once had. Even the sun cannot penetrate the open field where you and I once played in our separate dreams. Burns and burns. Those stones, what were they? Where did they come from?" Poem by poem, in memory of Cynthia Hurd, Susie Jackson, Ethel Lance, Reverend DePayne Middleton Doctor, Honorable Reverend Clementa Pickney, Taiwanza Sanders, Reverend Daniel Simmons Sr., Reverend Sharonda Singleton, Myra Thompson, shot and killed while at church, Charleston, South Carolina, 6/18/2015, RIP. Poem by poem, we can end the violence every day, after every other day. 9 killed in Charleston, South Carolina. They are not 9. They are each one alive. We do not know. You have a poem to offer. It is made of action. You must search for it. Run outside and give your life to it. When you find it, walk it back, blow upon it, carry it taller than the city where you live. When the blood comes down, do not ask if it is your blood. It is made of 9 drops. Honor them, wash them, stop them from falling. untitled, unfettered. Really, truly breathe, unfettered by the obligatory frames we cast for ourselves. It does not matter. Nevertheless, the question is, what are you going to do with all this life? For some odd reason, it is yours. You can live it. Not all of it, but you can live it for a little while. And if you do, you really will not need to live all of it. I'm going to end. First, I want to say this is such a marvelous evening. I feel so lucky to be here. I'm in the audience, actually. But thank you to everyone who was involved in putting this together. I'm going to read just two of my sister poems. And the first one is called Gesture. You stretched your hand across the table and said something I couldn't hear over the clatter of forks and plates, the restaurant's dumb chatter. And though the body, once thrown to the ground, bruised and bleeding for what it wanted, has a memory of its own, how the policeman laughed later. The body also speaks its own language, your hand open before me, and the world as if to say, I cannot save you, but held something like happiness in it. And thank you. And I'll just finish with this poem. Thank you. Communion. Communion. They open their mouths because the body's hunger speaks for the spirit. You know this by the way they close their eyes, how they push the world away, all that light through the window. It is unbearable to watch, as watching two people say goodbye at the airport is, almost. The public display of grief, how they hold each other in their private dark, which is its own brief prayer. Thank you.
Hello? How's this? Okay. Oh, wow, I feel so, like Blas said, so lucky to be here tonight and just restored to myself through this language and these poets. It just feels like such an honor. And my name's Bryn, and I'm going to be reading Audrey and Rich's work. And Audrian, I don't know if you even knew this, but she was maybe one of the big poets of my life who made me think I could be a poet and inspired me to do this whole thing. And so I got the email from Kate and Louise saying, oh, will you come down and read her work? And I thought, oh, I must have told Kate that story, but I don't think you knew that. I think it was just the wine and whatever you and Louise were cooking up. So thank you so much. So I'll start with a poem of mine, an elegy I wrote for her when she died in 2012, and then I'll read two of her poems. I'm sure many of you hopefully know her, because I didn't prepare many biographical notes, but I'm hoping a lot of you in the audience know of her and know her work. Fierce feminist poet, she has this wonderful book, What Is Found There? Notes on Politics and Poetry, right? The book of essays. And I assign it to my students, it's so relevant, I think, right now, as she just brings her beautiful intellectus or intellect or whatever that word was in Rant, the beautiful light of her mind onto thinking about the intersection of politics and poetry and power and the power of words. So this is called Elegy with a Black Horse. You tended the earth with your unquiet rage, waiting for rain the way some women wait for a man's dry fist to stop its music against the oak door. When you departed for the heartland, the weather of America knocked on your bones. Inland winters and salt air from the coast made claims to your muscle and your mind. Poetry and time were of no match for you. Your words outgrew the airless rooms of boxy stanzas, the way a black horse stays true to her body's desire for the quickest winds. On the day you died, I was pulling artichokes from the sweet soil, scraping my teeth against cupped leaves until the hearts lay bare like rope knots. Then I took from the field house grandfather's shovel, and I loaded the florets into the flatbed and drove until the valley disappeared into the slopes of Pacheco, and the sea arrived like a testament of blue, the color draping every dream I've had since you departed. What will we do with the many question marks you've made for us in sticks along the dark trail? In the bright light of madness, I turn to her and I turn to her, and nothing perceivable changes save a voice calling back from the shell of another. We are women, it says. We travel together. This is what you never failed to let us forget. Thank you. And here's a poem. This is poem number 7 from Adrienne Rich's 21 Love Poems, which is in the book The Dream of a Common Language. This is poem 7. What kind of beast would turn its life into words? What atonement is this all about? And yet, writing words like these, I'm also living. Is all this close to the wolverine's howled signals, that modulated cantata of the wild? Or, when away from you, I try to create you in words, am I simply using you like a river or a war? And how have I used rivers? And how have I used wars? To escape writing of the worst thing of all, not the crimes of others, not even our own death, but the failure to want our freedom passionately enough so that blighted elms, sick rivers, massacres would seem mere emblems of that desecration of ourselves. And thank you. And I'll close with this poem, One Night on Monterey Bay, The Death Freeze of the Century. And this is from An Atlas of a Difficult World. And this is a poem I heard her read when I think it was 2003, and I was in college at Berkeley, and I stumbled into the International House, you know, on campus. And there she was at the podium, and it was like just packed, standing room only. And she was this, you know, she was very small woman. And it was right after the second war with Iraq. And she had written this in the 90s during the first Iraq war as a protest poem. And I saw her there and just, wow, I thought, what is that magic? Like the way she was able to channel the collective sort of grief and rage, you know, of the moment in this beautiful, powerful, and yet kind of contained way. So this is the poem that lit it all up for me. So thank you again for being here tonight. Thank you. One night on Monterey Bay, the death freeze of the century. A precise, detached caliper grip holds the stars and quarter moon in arrest. The hardiest plants crouch shrunken, a killing frost of bougainvillea, pride of Madeira, roseate black-purple succulents, bowed juices sucked awry in one orgy of freezing, slumped on the streets, slumped on their stems like the old faces evicted from cheap hotels into the streets of the universe now. Earthquake and drought followed by freezing followed by war. Flags are blossoming now where little else is blossoming, and I'm bent on fathoming what it means to love my country. The history of this earth and the bones within it, soils and cities, promises made and mocked, plowed contours of shame and hope, loyalties, symbols, murmurs, extinguished and echoing, grids of states stretching westward, underground waters, minerals, traces, rumors I am made from, morsel, minuscule, fiber, one woman, like and unlike so many, fooled as to her destiny, the scope of her task, one citizen, like and unlike so many, touched and untouched in passing, each of us now a driven grain, a nucleus, a city in crisis, some busy constructing enclosures, bunkers to escape the common fate, some trying to revive the dead statues to lead us, breathing their breath against marble lips, some who try to teach the moment, some who preach the moment, some who aggrandize, some who diminish themselves in the face of half-grasped events, power and powerlessness run amok, a tape reeling backward in jeering, screeching syllables. Some for whom war is new, others for whom it merely continues the old paroxysms of time. Some marching for peace who for 20 years did not march for justice. Some for whom peace is a white man's word and a white man's privilege. Some who have learned to handle and contemplate the shapes of powerlessness and power as the nurse learns hip and thigh and weight of the body he has to lift and sponge day upon day as she blows with her every skill on the spirit's embers still burning by their own laws in the bed of death. A patriot is not a weapon. A patriot is one who wrestles for the soul of her country as she wrestles for her own being, for the soul of his country, gazing through the great circle at Window Rock into the sheen of the Vietnam Wall as he wrestles for his own being. A patriot is a citizen trying to wake up from the burnt-out dream of innocence, the nightmare of the white general and the black general posed in their camouflage to remember her true country. Remember his suffering land. Remember that blessing and cursing are born as twins and separated at birth to meet again in mourning. That the internal immigrant is the most homesick of all women and all men. That every flag that flies today is a cry of pain. Where are we moored? What are the bindings? What behooves us? Thank you.
I'm going to pretend I'm as tall as Bryn. I'm Amy Gerstler. I have the honor of reading a couple of poems by Czesław Miłosz. Czesław Miłosz, for those who might not be super familiar with him, was one of those brilliant, treasured figures in world literature who multiple countries would like to claim as their own. He was a Polish writer. He wrote poetry, novels, essays, and other works in Polish. He translated his own work and the work of others also. He was a respected translator. He was born in Lithuania in 1911 because his parents had fled Poland to Lithuania. He defected from Eastern Europe to Paris in 1951 and lived there for a little while. In 1960, he accepted a teaching position at UC Berkeley, which is one of the reasons why we are able to also claim him as a Western poet, a California poet. He became an American citizen in 1970 and lived in the United States for about the last 40 years of his life. In 1980, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He was a politically astute, very compassionate humanist, a public intellectual, and he died in 2004. The critic Paul Zweig said of Milosz's work that, quote, "He offers a modest voice speaking an old language, but this language contains the resources of centuries." Thank you to Louise Steinman for being my special personal Polish poetry consultant and suggesting, because this is an area of her expertise, suggesting poems of his to read. She herself and her work on this Aloud series is an amazing gift and resource for Los Angeles, as is Red Hen Press. And I am thrilled to hear that they've gotten a building and are going to have a new home. Woohoo! I'm going to read two Milosz poems and one of mine. The first Czesław Milosz poem is a kind of a well-known one of his, or a famous one of his, called A Song on the End of the World, and Louise suggested this wonderfully. A Song on the End of the World. On the day the world ends, a bee circles a clover. A fisherman mends a glimmering net. Happy porpoises jump in the sea. By the rain spout, young sparrows are playing. And the snake is gold-skinned, as it should always be. On the day the world ends, women walk through fields under their umbrellas. A drunkard goes sleepy at the edge of a lawn. Vegetable peddlers shout in the street, and a yellow-sailed boat comes nearer the island. The voice of a violin lasts in the air and leads into a starry night. And those who expected lightning and thunder are disappointed, and those who expected signs and archangels' trumps do not believe it is happening now. As long as the sun and the moon are above, as long as a bumblebee visits a rose, as long as rosy infants are born, no one believes it is happening now. Only a white-haired old man who would be a prophet, yet is not a prophet, for he's much too busy, repeats while he binds his tomatoes, "There will be no other end of the world. There will be no other end of the world." As is the case, I think, in their own ways with all of the poets who are reading their own work tonight and reading and honoring the work of other poets tonight, these are poets, I think, that have amazing things to give us at all times, and especially in the time we're living in now. And this is very true of Czesław Milosz, who lived through a series of both World War I and World War II, and a series of assorted dictatorships that he moved successive times to escape. This is his poem called This World. It appears that it was all a misunderstanding. What was only a trial run was taken seriously. The rivers will return to their beginnings. The wind will cease in its turning about. Trees, instead of budding, will tend to their roots. Old men will chase a ball. A glance in a mirror, they are children again. The dead will wake up, not comprehending, till everything that happened has unhappened. What a relief. Breathe freely, you who have suffered much. Okay, and then this is my little poem about talking to a head of lettuce called To a Head of Lettuce. To a Head of Lettuce. May I venture to address you, vegetal friend? A lettuce is no less than me, so I respect you. Though it's also true I may make a salad of you later. That's how we humans roll. Our species is blowing it big time, as you no doubt know. Dependent as you are on water and soil, we humans pollute. You're a crisp head, an iceberg lettuce, scorned in days of yore for being mostly fiber and water. But new research claims you've gotten a bad rap, that you're more nutritious than we knew. Juicy and beautiful, your leaves can be used as tortillas. If you peer through a lettuce leaf, the view takes on the translucent green of the newest shoots. Sitting atop your pile, next to heaps of radicchio, you do seem a living head, a royal personage who should be paid homage. I am not demanding to be reassured. I just want to know what you know, what you think your role is, and hear what you have to say about suffering long denied, the wisdom of photosynthesis, stages of growth you've passed through. I can almost hear your voice as I pay for you at the cash register, a slightly gravelly sound like Lamar Kendrick's voice or early Bob Dylan, both singers of gruff poetic truth. Nothing less was expected from you, Sister Lettuce. Nothing less. Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. Thank you, Louise. Thank you, Kate, for organizing yet another way of sort of tweaking the idea of a reading, you know, changing it up some. It's always nice. I'll be reading the work of Charles Bukowski tonight, which is funny because I don't like him terribly much. There are reasons for that. Maybe it's the performance of masculinity that he at times seems to be lampooning, but sometimes feels just too lived in. Gives me some trouble. But I'll tell you something. Wanda Coleman admired him. Wanda Coleman admired him enough to look at his work and see that perhaps his champion of a publisher, Black Sparrow Press, would look at some of her work. And eventually they did, and they did publish Mercurochrome. So every time I found myself kind of going, I would hear Wanda Coleman go, "Listen." So I'm going to listen at the same time that I'm going to speak. I decided not to read a ton of my own work, or any, really. Instead, I'm going to be in dialogue and discourse with Bukowski. There's a moment in his poem, "Days Like Razors, Nights Full of Rats," where he's looking across a bar where his speaker is. And it goes, "His face turns to me. Something you don't like, buddy? Yeah, you. Want to do something about it? Certainly." We finish our drinks, rise, move to the back of the bar, out into the alley. We turn each other, face each other. I say to him, "There's nothing but space between us. You care to close that space?" He rushes toward me, and somehow it's a part of the part of the part. So this is a little bit like that. I'm listening, Wanda. His bio is, oh gosh, it's impressive, right? Over 60 books, poetry, fiction, essays, screenplays. He was born in Germany in 1920 and moved to South Central in 1930. He died in 1994. I'm going to be reading some of this. This is Charles Bukowski's Screams from the Balcony, Selected Letters, 1960 through 1970. Many of them were addressed to someone named Douglas Blazek. So when I just say to Douglas, me, I'm occupying colonist. And you'll see what's about to happen. To Douglas, April 1965. I remember getting 10 pages letters from my old man while I was starving in cardboard shacks trying to write the great American short story. And when I first got the letter, I'd always flip through the pages and riffle them and search for them, but nothing green, nothing green, nothing green, nothing green, nothing green, and I'd be freezing my whole soul in a pitch of vomit darkness. And he'd write 10 fucking vindictive pages about America and making good. And it was worse than silence because he was rubbing it in. He had a place to shit, beans, turkey, a warm bed, a lawn to mow, names of neighbors, a seeming place to go each morning. To Douglas, they continue to build high-rise apartments all around here, and little men with hammers and steel helmets crawl around, fuck around, talk baseball and sex in the smoky sunlight, and I stare out the window at them like a demented man, watching their movements, wondering about them as the kid screams behind me and the old woman asks me, have you seen my comb? No, I haven't seen your comb. I tell her as a man walks by the window and his face contains the monsterism and brutality and sleepiness and false braveness of a million faces, of a million, million faces, of a million, million, million faces, of a million, 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 million faces. And I want to cry too, like the kid, but all I think is I'm out of beer and I'm broke and the world is burning shit and the flowers are ashamed. Something like that, not like all like that. Just mostly the first part and the rest crawling in my brain like some beetle. To Douglas. October 23rd, 1965. It has been 100 degrees for 3 or 4 days, and everybody smells like shit! And everybody is, of course. To Douglas, March 22nd, 1966. The dog poisoners are legion and slinky and seldom get caught, and we don't have enough death. They have to play dirt with the little we have left. I was supposed to go to war to save such creatures as these? The dog poisoners are usually members of long standing in the neighborhood, respected, churchly, own their own homes, and are often children, or their children have grown, and tend not to see them anymore. The dog poisoners are usually between the ages 55 and 70. Most of them loved animals as children, but American society and what it extracts from the body and the mind and the soul can grow very special monsters of its own. Beach trip. From the Love is a Dog from Hell, 1977, beach trip. The strong men, the muscle men, there they sit, down at the beach, cocoa tans, with the weights scattered about them, untouched. They sit as the waves go in and out. They sit as the stock market makes and breaks men and families. They sit while one punch of a button could turn their turkey necks to black and shriveled matchsticks. They sit while suicides in green rooms traded in for space. They sit while former Miss Americas weep before wrinkled mirrors. They sit with less life flow than apes, and my woman stops and looks at them. Ooh, 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 she says. I walk off with my woman as the waves go in and out. There's something wrong with them, she said. What is it? Their love only runs in one direction. The seagulls whirl and the sea runs in and out. And we left them back there, wasting themselves. Time, this moment, the seagulls, the sea, the sand. Listen, Doug, listen. Finally, oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm going to read a very short one. Working in the boiler rooms of Los Angeles poetry for a long time is Bill Moore. Boiler Room. And this is Poetry Loves Poetry, which is an anthology of Los Angeles poems. On the fire suicides of the Buddhists. They only burn themselves to reach paradise. Mim Nu. Original courage is good. Motivation be damned. And if you say they are trained to feel no pain, are they guaranteed this? Is it still not possible to die for somebody else? You sophisticates who lay back and make statements of explanation. I have seen the red rose burning, and this means more. Thank you. Oh my gosh, I'm being flanked. This is what happens to occupiers.
They get flanked. Thank you all, the poets. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Doug. Thank you, all of you, for coming. Please go look at the work of these wonderful poets out there. We have books for sale tonight from Red Hen Press. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.